Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I've spent the last year and a half interviewing political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders about their story and their place on the great battlefield. Now that we've had the midterm election, I've asked some of my guests to give me an update about how things went for them, their organization, and the country. This is the first in a series of episodes about the midterm. This one features two co-founders of new organizations that achieved quite a bit of prominence in 2018. The first is Betsy Hoover of Higher Ground Labs, which invests in the projects of progressive political technology entrepreneurs. HGL invested in 23 companies, many of whom made it onto the podcast in their own right, and so I wanted to hear from Betsy about what she learned and what her plans were going forward. And if you want more background on Betsy and her career, listen to episode 6. The second is Ross Morales Raquetto of Run for Something. Run for Something is recruiting and supporting young progressives to run for office. Run for Something ended up with a list of 20,000 potential candidates for office. I wanted to hear from Ross about how the candidates that Run for Something endorsed fared and what they learned and how they plan to tackle 2019 and 2020. If you want more background on Ross and his career, listen to regular episode number 12. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my new interviews with Betsy Hoover at Higher Ground Labs and Ross Raquetto at Run for Something.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
So I wanted to do a quick catch up with you since we just had a midterm. We talked almost exactly a year and a half ago, pretty busy year and a half, I think. And you were kind of getting Higher Ground off the ground, so to speak, at the time. And just wanted to get your sense of how the cycle went and kind of what you learned.
Well, so broadly, we took back the House and we have a check on a Trump White House. And that's, you know, in early 2017, that was the, like, most outstanding outcome we could have hoped for. And we organized and recruited better candidates and ran better campaigns in the House districts that we won in order to achieve that goal. And we should be really proud of that. I think the country feels like split. We won some really big victories and we also fell just a little bit short on some victories we cared a lot about. And so everyone's wrestling with that in their own way. But I think it's important for us as a movement to put in context. Like, we did something really big last week and something that was not a foregone conclusion when we talked last, when we set out on this journey a year and a half ago. So that's kind of big picture. In terms of Higher Ground Labs, over the past 18 months, we've invested in 23 companies, many of which were on the front lines of these campaigns and were fundamental pieces of infrastructure in the tech stack for the Democratic Party. And we're thrilled with that outcome. We know that a lot of those campaigns helped drive the outcomes that we were all so proud of and pumped about last week. And so that's a huge success for us and gives us a sense of how to direct our energies and our focus moving forward.
23 companies is a lot to keep track of and a lot, resources to put out there and mentoring and so on. And I think the range of outcomes varied among them, which is always the case. What would you say were the highlights?
Yeah, so there are three areas that we saw huge gains in innovation because of technology over the course of this cycle, and we were really proud to play a big role in each of those. First of all, Mobilize America kind of took the Democratic Party by storm this cycle, which it was amazing to watch, and they were one of our earliest investments. They really made volunteer recruitment and retention a team effort and created a collaborative model for what that could look like across campaigns, across outside organizations, and really across state lines. And that was an idea that Alan and Alfred had, but it was really just an idea when we started partnering with them. And it was amazing to see that come to the front lines this cycle. And I think really just scratched the surface for what's possible in cycles to come. So volunteer recruitment and retention with the collaborative model of organizing behind it was one, you know, huge area of success. A second, and we still have a ton to learn about this, but was the relational organizing space. You know, if 2016 was the year of peer-to-peer texting, which we also saw just huge gains in again this cycle, which was great, I think 2018 will be thought of as kind of the beginning of relational organizing. And Tuesday Company with their Team App and Voter Circle were the two HDL companies in that mix, but there were other successful platforms as well. And the thing that excites me so much about the relational organizing space is they took an organizing principle that has been around for a long time and did it digitally for the first time. So this idea that outreach from a friend is more powerful than outreach from a stranger, I was taught that in 2007 when I started organizing for Barack Obama. But this was the first cycle we saw what it might look like to really replicate that online at scale. And so every major contested congressional district in the country, plus many down ballot races and also Senate and gubernatorial races, had a relational organizing tool that they were piloting within their campaign program. And over the next couple of months, I think we're going to learn a ton about what worked there and what didn't, and how that shapes for 2020. But we made huge strides there with the number of people contacted by someone that they know because of these platforms in 2018. So it's the second area that we're super proud to have a role in. And then the third is really around messaging. You know, one piece of that was change research, which gained a ton of traction in the final weeks, taking polling online, making it faster, cheaper, and also accurate. And they were the only pollster to call the Gillum primary, the Gillum win in the primary, and proceeded to call close races across the country in the general. And so they did amazing work, but there's also really experimental strategies being piloted by Swayable, Avalanche, Grow Progress that all saw significant traction this cycle and only stand to grow as we head into 2019 and look towards 2020. So lots of people doing amazing things, but those three areas in particular, we saw a ton of innovation and a ton of growth this cycle.
Yes, all companies I've interviewed founders of on this podcast, and I think also have follow-up kind of post-mortem interviews with coming up along with yours, and a lot of impressive people. You guys did a great job of selecting the ones you've mentioned. What do you think that you have learned about committing capital in this space that you're going to apply going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first of all, in both 2017 and 2018, we started with a set of investment theses that we largely invested against, not 100%, but largely invested against, which basically came from the gaps that we were seeing in the ecosystem prior to doing our open call. And we're in the process of building those for 2019 and 2020, and they do look different than they looked for 2017 and 2018. And so we have strong conviction around the importance of naming those pain points that we want to help solve for, and also strong conviction that those will change over time. And so we'll continue to do that, hopefully better and with clearer focus in this next cycle. So that's one piece. The second piece is, seed capital is only step one in the process of growing a company, which isn't a surprise. I think we could have told you that when we started, but we've really seen the acute need that as a company grows and has needs to continue to scale and shore up as a technical platform, there are needs for additional capital. And so we're in the process of figuring out how we organize around that to make sure that the companies that are making an impact continue to be able to find support and success in kind of their next iteration in what is still a pretty new market. So I'd say that's a second area. And then a third thing that isn't really a surprise to me as an organizer, but I've been really excited to see, is just the importance of the community of entrepreneurs in the political tech space. We actually had the majority of our founders together on Monday to just talk about what they learned this cycle, what their experiences were, and how they're going to apply those learnings going forward. And it was just awesome to see the camaraderie, the shared learnings, the shared resources, the willingness to collaborate and, you know, find solutions that are mutually beneficial between these companies. And, you know, time and time again, we hear that one of the most valuable things that HGL can do for our founders is to help them connect with one another. And so, again, not a surprise to me as an organizer, but something I'm proud to have a role in now, and that HGL can continue to play as a convener and an organizer moving forward.
The flip side of companies needing more support as they go forward potentially is that some may need to pivot or cease operations. And there's a lot of talent in startups that don't make it for, you know, reasons of the market or execution. Or do you have plans for how to help out any of your portfolio that may not have found a gap that worked in the market?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so first of all, any early stage funder is, if every company that we invested in at a very early stage was off the chart successful, we'd be doing something wrong. Like any early stage funder is going to see some companies take off and see some risks that were great ideas and talented people and didn't find that place in the market. And so we think one of the benefits of the for-profit model in political technology is failing fast. If something doesn't work, we figure it out quickly. We don't waste time or resources on it, and we can move on. So we think there will be a decent amount of M&A in the political tech space, and that's good and healthy and one way to think about where the talent goes. We also, as kind of a center of gravity for this industry, you know, hope to help be able to do some of the matching. So if a company does kind of go away, either facilitating those founders, finding a home within another company, or finding a place for the kernel of that idea to continue to live on. And it's pretty early for that. Like, you know, we started 18 months ago. So it's pretty early for companies to be totally folding. But in the next year, I fully anticipate seeing, you know, some companies going away, some companies merging, some companies forming kind of integral partnerships so that the space can be stronger for everyone. And we're being really smart about where our resources go as a movement.
There are some types of things that may need to be fixed in the space that require amounts of capital far in excess of sort of typical seed. Have you thought about whether you have a role to play in that arena?
Yeah, we have thought about it quite a bit. And, you know, so there's kind of two axes there, I think. One is what happens when an idea needs a lot more than what a seed round typically raises. And the other is what happens when there's no business model for that idea, like when it's a core piece of infrastructure that isn't a for-profit. And we've seen both of them. And that can be the right answer for ideas. Like, we don't think that every technical solution by any means needs to follow or should follow our model. That's just the model that we're funding. So currently we're playing roles as partners, a little bit as funders, and as talent searchers for some of those projects that other people are generally spearheading. And that feels like the right role for HGL to play. We have a unique perspective on the space and you know, deep knowledge of who needs to integrate with who and who the players are. But we don't, you know, there's no way we're going to be the solution to every problem. So We see partnership and collaboration as a key part of the puzzle there.
How do you navigate the instances where you have companies in your portfolio that compete with each other or overlap to some degree with other investments that you've made?
Yeah, we have this in several areas within our portfolio, and it's a challenge, I think, for any investor and definitely for us. Personally, I believe that there is not a one-size-fits-all solution to most of these problems. You know, we're talking about campaigns that range from state ledge races in a rural district to presidential campaigns. And while both types of campaign may benefit from relational organizing, for example, they may need very different things in terms of UI, data and reporting, and accessibility. And so we feel fine about supporting multiple companies within the market that have some similar tendencies. Because our program is so collaborative in nature and community-based in nature, that also depends a ton on the founders. And we have founders of really like the highest quality, both as people and as technical and political minds. And so they've been really willing to come into our space with a collaborative approach and learn from one another and share with one another, even though they may be competing for similar clients. And, you know, without that approach, our work would be really hard. But instead, you know, we're fine supporting multiple companies that fit different needs. We're fine if down the line companies merge and take the best ideas from one another to continue to grow the space as a whole. And, you know, we're fine if one wins at the end of the day. But at the seed stage, we're willing to make multiple bets to really figure out what works and what solves the pain points that were there long before we were.
You speak about pain points and gaps and unmet needs. Can you give us any preview of what you're looking at in that regard for, say, your next cohort?
Yeah, I mean, we're very much still in the process of figuring this out. And we're actually interviewing tons of folks that were on the ground in 2018 to make sure we have this right. So I can talk about areas that I'm interested in, but these aren't by any means like solidified theses. All the conversations yet to come are still very, very important. But spaces that we're paying attention to, you know, there continues to be data and integration challenges that are a little bit more back of house. That we're paying attention to figure out how to ease that barrier for especially campaigns with less technical staff. We still saw this cycle campaigns across the country using paperless for canvassing, which is like an age-old challenge that we just haven't solved yet. And so trying to get to the bottom of what the challenges are there is something that we're interested in. But then the other big space is around misinformation, how to identify misinformation, and how to produce content at a level that competes with a lot of the misinformation that people are getting. And so that's another area that, first of all, we will be all ears during our open call for people who have interesting solutions to that problem. I don't think we know the answer by any means yet. But two is just going to continue to evolve. We saw new things in 2018 from what we saw in 2016, and we're going to see new things in 2020 from what we saw in 2018. So that's one of the places we're looking for really outside the box thinking on what's possible.
Betsy, what surprised you the most about the last 18 months, particularly with, you know, the lens of Higher Ground?
Two things. One thing I was very pleasantly surprised about: there are so many incredibly talented technologists and business leaders who have great ideas when it comes to the role of technology in politics and are willing to throw their lives into doing this work. Just when I thought we'd be scraping the bottom of the barrel to get a new set of companies or a new set of resumes to help our companies fill key roles, people would kind of come out of the woodwork and say, there's nothing else I'd rather be doing, who had this skill set that we needed. And so just the talent has been amazing and it just keeps coming. And that is so encouraging for the future of our country, I think. The flip side of that is and I shouldn't be surprised by this, I've been in campaigns for a long time, but the adoption curve for new technology is still really steep. It is hard to get campaigns to and outside organizations to adopt and really make the best use of new technologies. And I think there's a bunch of reasons for that, some that are totally justified and some that are not. But it's something we really as a movement need to solve, because the people who are losing out as a result of that challenge are voters who don't have information available to them in the places that they're spending time or aren't being reached in a way that resonates with them. And so that's something that Higher Ground will continue to think about as we head towards the next cycle, definitely in partnership with lots of others who are doing interesting work in that space.
What advice would you give to would-be founders that would love to find a spot with you?
Yeah. So thank you for that platform. We will do our next open call for 2019 startups. It'll open up in January. And so if you have an idea that you're trying to wrap your head around now, do it. Like, it's worth it. Do it. There are needs out there. There's opportunity. And, you know, we really want to hear from you. One thing that we are finding is critical to the success of early companies is to have a founding team. And so if you have an idea, find someone to partner up with who shares your idea and shares your passion. Because most of these things do better when there's multiple brains on it. So founding teams are really important. Diverse teams are really important. And people thinking outside the box, thinking really creatively about, you know, the pain points that we know exist are really important. So apply, don't be scared. And we're excited to have a new crew in 2019.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Anything else you would like to say?
Congrats to the people who have worked really hard over the past 18 months and saw a lot of their effort come to fruition last week. It was a big deal and something we should take maybe another couple of days to be proud of before diving into fighting on the next frontier. But congratulations and proud to be working with all of you.
And I just like to congratulate you for, you know, founding one of these many organizations that had a lot of impact. I think you guys are really making change in the political technology market for progressives, and that's great to see.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. So excited to keep going.
That was Betsy with Higher Ground Labs. Now, Ross Morales-Riquetto with Run for Something. So, you know, it's been quite a while since we last talked. And when we did, what I remember is that you had just an enormous number of candidates that were saying that they potentially wanted to run for office. You want to catch me up on sort of what happened at Run for Something through to the midterm?
Totally. When we first got off the ground, you know, like in large part, a lot of our focus was handling like the overwhelming demand that was out there in terms of working with 10,000 or 11,000, 12,000 candidates that we'd had come in at the time. Today, we have about 20,000 candidates who've expressed interest in running for office. In the midterm elections this year, we had around 400 candidates, 155 of them won on election day. So we're extremely excited. We still have a number of races that are either too close to call and the votes are still being counted. Shout out to California, or are going to end up going into runoffs. So we've got those in a couple of states. It was really fascinating to watch this cycle play out, because the 155 candidates who won, of those folks, about 56% of them were women, about 49% of them were people of color, about 16% of them were LGBTQ. Those folks were more diverse even than our initial like endorsement pool, which we found really, really encouraging. You know, on top of all that, we know that at least 35 or so of the races that we worked in flipped a state legislative seat from red to blue this cycle.
So there's a huge difference between the 20,000 candidates or potential candidates and the hundreds who ran. Are you not tracking races down at the very local level? Or what happened with the 19,000 plus candidates that are just sort of on your list?
What we find is that sort of at any given time, around 10% of our candidates are on the ballot. There is all sorts of reasons why we may not have made an endorsement in 2017 or 2018. Some of those being some of the folks may not have applied for an endorsement. I think, though, that actually where a lot of that is that a majority of the folks who are on the list expressed an interest in running, and most of them are still trying to figure out when. So we expect and anticipate that there will be a decent number of folks running in some of the 2019 municipal races, as well as like the handful of legislative races that are going on: Louisiana, Mississippi, New Jersey, Virginia. And as we go into 2020, we know that a lot of these folks, we've been hearing, actually, as a matter of fact, from a lot of these folks that they're really interested in running in the 2020 cycle or even beyond that.
What kind of resources do you make available to candidates that you endorse or candidates that you don't endorse? Because I've heard from various people along the way about partnerships that you are involved in with, you know, like training organizations or other types of campaign entities.
Totally. So, I mean, we do two really basic things. The first is we recruit candidates, and as we move into 2019 and 2020, we're going to spend even more time and energy focused on the recruitment piece. The second is around candidate support. And specifically, there's a couple of different buckets that we engage in around candidate support. The first is around building community. So we get candidates connected to each other. We get candidates connected to other folks that may be helpful to them, like across the progressive movement, whether, you know, that's Emerge America, whether that's, you know, National Democratic Training Committee or other organizations that are out there working. I would say this is one of the buckets that a lot of the candidates especially appreciate, especially because, you know, it's really difficult. Running for office is really difficult. And many of these candidates, especially as they're starting, don't know a lot of other people who've been through this experience before, or don't specifically know people who are currently going through it. The second thing that we do is we provide mentorship support to candidates. So that ranges from, you know, a network of 500 or so political operatives that we've assembled, all the way to, you know, for our endorsed candidates, each candidate gets a regional director. So somebody specifically in their region who can help them, you know, think through what a campaign looks like, what they are doing, helps them assess what's going on in their campaign. And then those folks help them sort of like move through the campaign cycle. The third thing we do is we make endorsements of candidates. And, you know, to some degree, we raise candidates a little bit of money. We've been able to push volunteers out to candidates. And then we've also been able to get candidates connected to like other types of like pro bono services that they may not have been able to get otherwise, ranging, you know, from graphic design, videos, websites, etc.
How are you guys doing as an organization? Have you grown? Have you staffed up? You know, how did you raise funds? What's the business model?
Yeah, as of right now, we're about 17 people strong. I think as of the last time we talked, I bet we were somewhere around 4 or 5. So we've grown pretty significantly since then. For us, the model is we don't charge anything for our candidates, and that'll never change. We see ourselves as a piece of infrastructure on the left. So, you know, we're not here to exist from election cycle to election cycle. You know, our intention is to be here in the long term. You know, like every organization, we raise money, you know, somewhere between like 45 and or 40 and 50% of our funds come from grassroots money. We raise money from other sources as well. We made an intentional decision at the very beginning around revenue generation and making sure that things would be made available for free to candidates, especially just since there's so many things that candidates have to pay for already. And especially at the down ballot level, resources for campaigns are finite. And so, you know, we wanted to be additive rather than, you know, like taking away from that.
There were so many organizations that started up after 2016, and you're one of them, but a lot of them didn't make it, or, you know, certainly didn't grow to be 17 people in size. What do you think was different about Run for Something that led it to get so much headway?
Totally. I think there's a couple things. I think one is that my co-founder Amanda and I have both been working in the political space for a while. I myself, you know, have been working in politics for about 15 years now between state and local races and national work. And Amanda has worked multiple election cycles for multiple presidential campaigns at this point. We came into it with a knowledge of what the political system and looks like at the very beginning and where there were opportunities for intervention. I think the other piece of it is that we never really saw ourselves necessarily as a, like, quote unquote resistance organization. We saw ourselves as a piece of long-term infrastructure. And so we set ourselves up in such a way that that was like at the forefront of all of the things that we were doing. We have a pretty clear mission and the need is extremely clear. We worked really, really hard to make sure that we weren't being duplicative of what other people were already doing and that we would always be additive. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, when you've got a really clear mission, it makes a lot of things significantly easier.
What do you think was the biggest impact that you had through 2018?
I mean, it always comes down for us to the candidates. We've elected now about 200 candidates since we first started in 2017. And that's 200 more people that's 200 people that weren't like young, diverse, progressive folks that weren't in elected office before. And I think if you want to look at some of the significant changes that these folks have been making, it's really easy to look at the folks who are in the Virginia House of Delegates. Before the 2017 election, Governor McAuliffe had been working tirelessly to pass Medicaid expansion, but had never been able to get across the finish line. We almost flipped the chamber in Virginia and like kept a Democratic governor in place. And then we got Medicaid expansion. Hundreds of thousands of people who weren't able to have access to healthcare now have it. We're going to see that on a whole different scale this cycle. There's a woman named Lena Hidalgo who just got elected down in my hometown of Houston. Shout out. She just got elected to be the Harris County judge. And for those who don't know, which is like basically everybody, the Harris County judge is actually the county executive. Harris County is the third largest county in America. She's a 28-year-old woman who immigrated from Colombia when she was a small child, and she's now going to be in charge of one of the largest counties in America. This is a person who like beat an incumbent Republican who had been there for 11 years, who's going to completely change the, you know, way that that county operates, when like ranging from, you know, like the way that the county jail is run. She campaigned pretty heavily on getting rid of cash bail. I think that will probably be a priority of hers pretty quickly when she gets there. And that's like, you know, one of the largest jails in the state. So I think it's really easy to look at the work that these candidates have done and are going to do and just be really, really inspired by the fact that we do the political stuff in service of getting people elected who can make a real difference in people's lives. And 200 new people elected to these types of offices are going to make massive impacts in the lives of millions of people.
Part of what helped get you going was this kind of backlash against the Trump election and the energy that that created. Do you think that we can match that going forward for this next cycle? There's obviously a ton more work to do to move things in a progressive direction between 2018 and 2020.
Yeah, so we did research with Data for Progress that we published right before the election. And it was about the makeup of our candidates and what they said when they were signing up to run for office. What they found from that is while Donald Trump might have been an initial catalyst for folks getting more engaged and involved, mentioning Donald Trump or talking about Donald Trump as a reason why they're running for office actually made someone less likely to run for office. And what we found is that among the people who did end up choosing to run for office, most of those folks actually cited local issues or problems that they wanted to solve as reasons for running for office. So what I'd say is I think in large part Trump was a catalyst for a lot of the energy that we saw right now, but I think he is not the reason necessarily that people continue to fight and engage, especially at the local level. We also found that, for a majority of our candidates this cycle, most of them weren't running against Donald Trump. They were running to solve problems that were specific to their individual communities. To some degree, we don't need a reminder of how crappy Donald Trump is. We see it every day in the news, and I think people feel it. But, when you're at the local level, I think everyone took this lesson from the victory in Virginia with Danica Rome last cycle, which was, all she did was talk about traffic. I think a lot of candidates took that to heart this cycle. And I think as a result of that, saw victories in places where we don't typically win. We saw that at the state ledge level for sure, in a number of states. We also saw it at the municipal level. We've got candidates running in all sorts of areas this cycle at the municipal level that typically wouldn't be able to win in bright red areas, who, hunkered down, talked about issues, and honestly focused on having one-on-one conversations with voters and pulled out their races, or came so close that they're definitely going to run in 2020 and think that they have an even better shot then.
You obviously came into the cycle knowing a lot, you and your partner knowing politics. What new things did you learn? Or what's the key thing that you did learn?
I think it was less about what individual new thing I learned and more about the value of things that I already knew that sometimes I think we forget, which is, it's piggybacking a little bit on the last point, that it's the name of the game in so many of these races is getting the opportunity to make connections with voters. There's literally no replacement for it. When a candidate can go out and make connections with voters, it changes everything. It means that when their opponent sends out a piece of direct mail or multiple pieces of direct mail in the last 2 weeks, that when a voter gets it, they'll look at that piece of mail and they'll actually be able to reconcile that mail with the person that they met at their front door or that they met, at an event. There's literally no replacement, I think, for a candidate knocking on a door or having a one-on-one conversation with a voter. And I think in the discussion about what tactics work and what tactics don't work, we often forget that, especially as the races get larger, just because it's harder and harder, the larger races, for candidates to make those connections with voters. I would honestly, to some degree, point to Beto and to Stacey Abrams for examples of how candidates at the statewide level were able to make connections with voters in ways, you know, where they weren't actually knocking on everyone's doors. So I think I would say in all of the conversations about canvassing tactics and like whether direct mail works, at like digital ads versus television ads, text messages, etc. I think those are all very extremely worthy conversations to have. I think they all should be had. But I think at the end of the day, the question that we should be asking ourselves is how can we make sure that our candidates are able to do a better job of making connections with individual voters, even if it's through a mass medium? The candidates who really thought about that and took that to heart this year, I think, did a lot better.
It sounds to me very much like you continue as an organization. Assuming that, what changes do you make going forward?
We learned a lot of really valuable lessons for 2018. For our candidate support program, we're going to continue to build on what we've already got and just expand it, you know, make it respond to some of the things that our candidates said that they were interested in getting from us. We'll probably stop doing certain things that folks said they didn't find as helpful. The big thing that we're, you know, so that's gonna be an ongoing process throughout our existence. I think like we know how to make adjustments. The thing that we're gonna do that's I wouldn't say new but different is, you know, as we move into 2019 and 2020, it's gonna be our goal to build, you know, long-term year-round candidate recruitment, national candidate recruitment infrastructure. Not that candidate recruitment infrastructure doesn't already exist in individual states and across the country. And it's going to be our goal essentially to build one like the largest top of the funnel that we've ever had in Democratic politics. You'll be hearing a lot more about it relatively soon. We'll probably be making some announcements in the next few weeks with more specifics, but you know, you'll be seeing more like Run for Something stuff on the ground in partnership with other organizations that already exist in states. You'll probably see more of us online around candidate recruitment specifically. And then, you know, you'll probably see like folks out actually in communities trying to do like individual candidate recruitment. Yesterday was National Run for Office Day, a holiday that we invented last year and had so much success with it, did it again this year. This year, we doubled the number of candidates we recruited in a single day. We're still getting the final numbers since it was yesterday, but we had over 65 organizations from across the progressive movement participate. We had a large number of like influencers and elected officials and like local candidates participate this year. So it was a huge success. We were really excited about it. We'll continue doing it. National Run for Office Day as a holiday will continue. And, you know, like we're really excited to make it bigger next year. In subsequent years. So the pieces where we're looking to make sort of like new investments will be around candidate recruitment specifically.
Ross, it's really impressive what you guys are doing and exciting. Anything else you want to say?
No, this is great. I appreciate what you do. And it was cool to get to do this again. I don't know, maybe a year after I did it the last time.
That was Betsy and Ross with Higher Ground Labs and Run for Something. They created two impressive organizations, and I'm eager to see what they do this upcoming cycle. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.